And both of these concern a new member of the family. One mother preparing her little girl for another arrival said, "Which would you rather have, a little brother or a little sister?" And she said, "A litter of puppies." And another little boy was told by a neighbor, "Oh, I see that heaven sent you a little gift, a little brother, baby brother." "Yes," said, "heaven wanted it quiet up there." And not very long ago, I was examining a class in catechism, and I said to a little boy, "What is a niche in the church?" He said, "A niche in the church is the same as niche anywhere else, except you can't scratch it in church." The subject tonight is, have you been tempted more lately and enjoying it less? Have you ever seen that commercial? Did you know what Oscar Wilde said about temptation? He said he could resist anything but temptation. I heard of a group of lumberjacks who could not resist temptation. They had not been to confession in years. And they came in, a couple dozen of them, and they sent the bravest of them all into the confessional box first. And he began his confession by saying, "Father, I've committed every sin a man can commit." Father said, "Ever commit murder?" "No," he said, "that's right. That's one sin I never committed." "Well, now," he said, "you see, you haven't committed every sin. Go out of the box, examine your conscience again, number, kind, and circumstance, and then come back." So as he stepped out of the box, he saw the long line of lumberjacks outside. Put up his hand and he said, "No use tonight, boys. Just hearing murder cases." Well, we introduced the subject of temptation by saying that today there is a grave psychological error abroad to the effect that if you have tensions, you're abnormal. And that therefore you ought to go to a psychiatrist. You're abnormal if you have tensions. There are certain tensions that are fundamental to human nature. They are natural to us. One, because we have a body which seeks one kind of pleasure, and then we have a soul, the mind, which seeks another kind of joy. They have different landing fields. In the morning, for example, the mind will say, "Get up," and the body says, "Don't get up. Stay where you are." Did you ever hear the story about the Irishman that came over to this country and hired out to a farmer, and the farmer called him at 4 o'clock in the morning? And the Irishman said, "What for?" Farmer said, "We're going to cut the oats." "Are there wild oats?" said the Irishman. "No," said the farmer, "they're not wild oats." He said, "Then why do you have to be snaking up in the dark on them?" And it isn't easy, simply because we have this basic conflict of body and mind, to bring the two into unity and to make the body serve the soul. Remember, our blessed Lord spoke of that in the garden when the apostles were asleep. He said, "The flesh is willing, but the spirit is weak." There's a law of the mind fighting against the law of the members. The law of the body fighting against the law of the mind. And it takes much struggle and discipline to bring them together. Now, here are some of the tensions that are in us, tensions which are apt to become temptations. We have in us certain passions, drives, libidos, urges, instincts, call them anything you please. They are three. First of all, there is a, one is related to the mind. The other is related to the body. And the other related to things outside of both of us, namely the world itself, or just simply things. Now, if we did not have a drive or an urge or a passion in our mind and in our body and toward things outside of us, we would never perfect our personality. It's thanks to the impulsion of the mind, for example, that we have knowledge. We seek to know truth. Then there are the drives of the body, which give us pleasures, which are essential for life. Pleasures of eating, pleasures of drinking, pleasures of marriage, and the like. Then there are things outside of us, and we have an urge to possess them. Our soul is our own. That's the fundamental basis of liberty. But we like to have some external guarantees of liberty, and so we like to call things our own, hence the passion for private property. And also for security in general. Hence we must never think that any of these urges that we have in us are fundamentally wrong. They are not, they're God implanted. They can, of course, become wrong. They can become irregulated. They can become disordered. There can be too much of them. There could even be a defect. For example, it is possible for this urge for knowledge to turn into pride, sophistication, envy, jealousy. And it's possible for the urge of the body toward legitimate pleasures to become disordered. One could have gluttony. One could have alcoholism. Lust. That's no commercial, that alcohol. And then our drive for things could become disordered, and we could have greed, theft, avarice, envy of others' property, and the like. A river, for example, is a good thing as long as it is kept in an embankment. When it loses that restraint, it becomes a swamp. Fire is good in a hearth, but it's no good in a roof. Water is good to drink, but it's not good when it drowns us. Ants are good in an anthill, but ants are not good in... Are they? Make you too nervous. Took too long to follow that out. So that we have within us, therefore, certain urges, which are all right, but we have to watch and control them. Now I'm going to tell you, as soon as my angel cleans the blackboard, and he does it instantaneously, none of the detergents that they use on advertisements of television can compare with the detergent of my angel. We're keeping that a secret. I'm going to explain the way modern psychology describes these tensions or what might be temptations. And the modern psychological explanation is entirely too simple. Now, I always tell you what everything is. This is the beginning of a ship. These are waters around the ship. That's the pilot house with the pilot up there. This is a boiler, and there's water that comes in from outside into the boiler. According to modern psychology, you have only two important factors to describe man. Consciousness, that which is above the water level, and unconsciousness, that which is below and sometimes gets just a little bit beneath the ego. And according to this theory, if there are abnormalities, well, all you have to do is to sometimes analyze the water that gets into the ship if it's sinking. Bring it up to consciousness here. Analyze it. And then you prevent the ship from sinking. Man, isn't that simple? You do not explain, for example, an oak when you find the rotted acorn from which it came? This explanation is really quite unscientific. It's like leaving blood out of a bloodhound. It doesn't explain those things which are specific to man. Now, there are other factors, you see. Now, here is the true psychological explanation. Here is the captain. Got to have a captain on a ship. It's got to be a helm. Then there are sails. Remember that. Those are sails. Then there's also a port. Looks like a bottle, doesn't it? And then in addition to that, there is a star. That star looks as if it had been out all night, doesn't it? Then there are winds. Now, man is a reasonable creature. He's controlling a ship. He has a destiny. He has a goal. He's got a purpose in life. If he doesn't have any purpose in life, then indeed he's apt to become frustrated and psychotic and neurotic, as so many people are without a goal and purpose in life. And so the pilot of the ship signifies reason, conscience, morality. Then he gives directions. He steers the ship with a helm. This is the will. And the will executes the judgment. And he directs it to the port. And he's got help outside of the ship. He's got the guidance of the fixed heavens to signify the moral law and God to guide man. The wind signifies the passions. It's possible for the pilot to so direct the ship that it will not be wrecked. These are the urges. We described before the urges of knowledge to become pride, the urges of the body to become lust, and gluttonous and the like, and the urge for security to become greed and avarice. Man, therefore, is really quite a complicated being. Now, the problem is, what happens when we're tempted? And what are the stages of a temptation? Now, for example, here I am talking to you. You do not realize it, but there's a microphone. Whenever I'm on television, it's only about 6 or 8 inches above my head. I do not know how often the sound man is tempted, the boom man. Casey let down the boom once, remember? Now, the boom man could let that down. Would the camera pick up the... is there a way of picking up the camera that's over my head? The boom? You see it? Now, he could let that down on my head any moment that he wants. I don't know whether he's tempted to do it or not, but at any rate, he's resisting the temptation. I will explain what happens in a temptation. See, here's reason, and here are the passions and the senses. And after a while, when one begins to be tempted very strongly, reason is apt to become clouded, so that the senses and the passions become all important for the moment. We forget the moral law. We forget our education. We forget our destiny for the moment. But we're never tempted beyond our strength. Nor are we even to think that some people are tempted more than others. Some just give way more than others, and then they get tempted more. And then temptations vary with age. Generally, in the young, it's temptation to lust. Middle age is the temptation to power, and avarice is the sublimation of both in old age. Now, there are three steps in a temptation. The temptation is not wrong. We're tempted. We have these tensions because we're normal. We wouldn't be human if we weren't tempted. Very often, the stronger we are, the more we're tempted. Not just base temptations, but the temptations of our blessed Lord. Temptations on a very high level. Now, there are three stages. The first is suggestion. In other words, something comes to your eye, to your ear, to your memory, to your imagination. Second stage is delight. There's still no morality involved. In other words, it gives you pleasure. You think, oh, I'd like to have that. I'd like to do that. I'd like to steal that $1 million. What I could do with it. Still, there's no sin here up to this point. One can only sin with the will, consent. Now, let me explain these three and explain them in an amoral fashion. First, let me explain it in terms of a woman dieting. She's resolved. Now, there's no morality involved in this, is there? This woman is dieting. She's resolved she isn't going to eat any more desserts. So she's out to dinner. A waiter comes along, offers her lemon meringue pie. He says, madam, would you like to have 250 calories? That's a suggestion. She looks at it. Then her reason, her resolution now become a bit clouded, and she begins to delight in that, and she says, she's a big glob of cream on top of it, and she says to herself, after all, it's only lemon. Lemon is fruit, and fruit isn't fattening. Why shouldn't I have it? Furthermore, I haven't got my car parked in front of the house. It's down 20 feet. I can walk off the pie. Then my skin is too dry. I've had a lot of trouble with it lately. The cream would give it oil. And then I remember, too, a lady friend of mine that was coming home from dinner, and her car skidded, and she was almost in danger of running into a truck. And I said to her, what did you think about just at that moment when you almost hit the truck? She said, I was thinking, well, if I'm going to be killed, I wish I'd taken that dessert. So finally she says, yes, I'll take the lemon meringue. That's the consent. Now take, for example, a man who is contemplating divorce. He's a married man. Goes out to a party. He meets a lovely lady who has been married before. And he's introduced to her. That's the suggestion. And then he talks to her. Finds her very intelligent. Not like his wife. His wife doesn't understand him. So he thinks, well, I'd like to have her to dinner. And he said to her, would you like to join my expense account? And so at the table, he says to her, what do you have for dinner? And she said, well, I'll have some pâté de foie gras. And after that, some pheasant under glass. Provided you're not saving the money to buy me a ring. So he finds her not only intelligent, but very humorous. And 6 months later, we read in the paper that that man and his wife have been divorced on the grounds of incompatibility. That's the consent. And so the temptations, therefore, are normal to every single person in the world. Blessed is the man who has suffered temptations. Because when he overcomes, he's stronger. As you go up in life, this ink well, for example, doesn't have any temptations. It's too simple. You get a living thing, a rose has much more resistance to meet. The man, we have tremendous forces to meet, not only in this world, but even from the outer world, too. Now, what happens when one consents? Remember we said that before, in a temptation, the passions and the senses now began to overrule reason, and they sought some kind of deordination. When the temptation has ended and one has consented, one has secured what one wants, what one wanted, then there's no longer the urge. The chase is over when you've captured the rabbit. Then very often there follows a disgust because reason now sees things very clearly. That's why Judas, for example. Judas, after he had betrayed our blessed Lord, brought back the 30 pieces of silver. He had them hidden in the cincture of his robe. And anxious to get rid of them, he didn't want them. He loved silver beforehand. Now that he had finally finally resolved his temptation, he takes a knife and he rips open his cincture and throws the 30 pieces of silver sprawling and jingling across the temple floor. And he said to the authorities, I have sinned against innocent blood. He no longer wanted what he had. He hated himself for it. And in that despair that some people have because they know not the mercy of God and they know only this world, despair of that kind draws people either to suicide or alcoholism. So Judas took the cincture, threw it over the limb of a tree on the edge of a precipice, and the cincture had been weakened by cutting out the 30 pieces of silver, and he fell down the precipice. His bowels burst asunder. Peter sinned too, but Peter went to the Lord and asked for mercy, which indeed Judas could have done. So temptations are part of life, and to remind us that they are, our blessed Lord himself was tempted. He was led by the Spirit into the desert, tempted not as we are. His temptation came from the fact that he was God in the form of man, and the devil offered him 3 shortcuts to the conquest of the world. And the first shortcut was, be an economic king. Give the people bread. Turn stones into bread. Everyone will follow you. Then you'll be the kind of a Messiah that everyone wants. Do not take up a cross. And the second temptation was, do something spectacular. Some great technological, scientific wonder. Throw yourself from a steeple and be unhurt. What people like are marvels. Rockets sent to moons. Things like that. They'll win souls. But don't worry about a cross. And then finally Satan said, you want to win the world, don't you? Well, fall down and adore me. I'll give you the world. I'm master of it. Very frightening thought it was indeed. And our blessed Lord refused to fall down before him. He said that he would be lifted up. He said he did not want Satan's world. All that he wanted was an earth that was large enough to contain a cross. That's why he came. And he would not take the shortcuts to it. And it is in virtue of that conquest over temptations that we win in his name.